But I think in terms of why you write songs, that also really does matter. Are you writing to explore yourself and share that? Because if that's the reason why you're recording music, then I think you have a really strong case to be able to connect with other people just like yourself that you might not even realize.
Hey there. Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your fellow student and host. In this episode, I spoke with Noah Frank. Noah is a singer-songwriter, drummer, innovation consultant, and overall creative. He has busked all around the country, grown his own music business, and released music under his alter ego artist name, Far. Noah grew up as an extrovert with a stutter, and in this episode, you'll hear Noah tell his story of finding singing and music as a means to express himself when he couldn't through words. I hope you enjoy the episode. Noah, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. So excited to get to know you a little more.
Well, thanks for having me.
Where I would love to start is taking you back to your childhood and thinking about Noah, age 7, 8, 9. And as you think about yourself that age, how, in what ways were creativity coming out?
It's a really interesting question. And I love the question because so many of these things just do have their roots in longstanding practices that you build over the years. I think for me, one thing that you have to know about me off the bat is that when I was 7, 8, and 9, I could not speak to you like this. And I literally mean, I was later diagnosed as fluent, but I do have a stutter. And when I was younger, it was particularly triggered whenever I'd get excited. And that was always challenging being an extrovert because I get so excited about things and topics and meeting people that I just go up to them and I would say, and I couldn't even get a word in. So creativity from a young age, it's a really interesting question because when I was 7, 8, and 9, that is when I started to feel the gravitational pull toward singing. And it's actually directly because of that stutter. At the time, the teachers didn't know what to do with me. So I found that a lot of the infrastructure that was there to support me in schools wasn't, let's say, as robust. And so I looked forward every day to the 30 minutes that I got with my music teacher, Mrs. Gasta. She, from a young age, encouraged me to sing. And singing for me was the one place where I didn't stutter. So kids would look at me funny. I'd be playing on the playground and I'd be so excited to be all over the place. But when I was in music class, that was the one place that was like home. So when I was 7, 8, and 9, that's when I started my deluge into classic rock, and singing very quickly morphed into a number of other instruments that I picked up thereafter.
Wow, what an amazing story. That is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, and we can get into this more. I think when you grow up with a barrier to communication, it's fascinating. There's so much that we still don't understand about why stutters come on. And not all stutters are cut and dice the same. When I was a bit older, I finally got help for it after I was in a French class, and I knew the sentence. I'll never forget. I knew the sentence that I wanted to say, and I could not get it out. And so I took about 2 minutes, and my French teacher said, "Okay, well, you're looking for this." And I said, "Hang on, no, I got it. I know it. I just can't say it." So that's when I joined my first support group. And when I was 16, I walked into this big group room at the University of Connecticut, where there were people of all kinds of ages. I was the youngest, but these were, you know, fully career professionals. These were retirees up to their 80s. And stutters are different depending on whether you stutter at the onset of your words or at the end of your words or in the middle. They're different levels of severity. So I'm diagnosed as fluent. I stutter mostly at the beginning of my words, which is interesting. That means that when we're talking like this in a relaxed pace, I know we're in a good space, you won't hear me trip up on any words. If I had to go up and give a huge speech in front of a 10,000 person audience, I'd do maybe okay, but I would probably still stutter over some of my words. That's where those, you know, anxiety/nerves come in. And all of that goes away with singing.
That is fascinating. I like want to understand neurologically why.
I also had the exact same interest in affixation, right? For me, I like to joke that my left brain and my right brain don't always agree or don't always know what page the other's on. But it is absolutely fascinating because this doesn't seem to, you know, I know for a fact I'm not the only person that suffers from this. For example, a prominent stutterer you may not know was Elvis.
Wow.
So it's actually a documented thing that folks who stutter, right, when they sing and when they get into music, it's a totally different way to express yourself. And so what became of that? To go back to your first question. So when I was 7, 8, and 9, I was listening to all the classics, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles. My dad was a college radio DJ. So he made sure that I got my classic rock education, that I had a foundation. So when everybody else was listening to Bruno Mars, I was that kid who was like, yeah, have you heard of Led Zeppelin? Yeah, yeah. Have you heard of the Monkees? So I say all this because I read up on all the greats. I took 2 weeks of guitar lessons when I was 8 years old, because I wanted to be a singer-songwriter, you know, writing songs, which I'll get more to in a second. After 2 weeks of guitar lessons, I was like, yeah, I'd rather just bang on some drums. So after that, became my long love for the drums. I'm still a drummer. I play in a couple bands now.
That's your primary instrument, is the drumming.
That's my primary instrument. So it's interesting. So I've always been a singing drummer. If you can believe that.
That is really interesting. That's so challenging.
Look, it's more of a breathing exercise than anything else, I think. So I started my first band when I was in middle school, and, you know, like all middle school, we all drifted apart. But I DM'd, and this was my bravest moment. So you can imagine, you know, 5'5", stuttering me, all of my freckles when I was 14, I hit up one of the youngest starters on the varsity basketball team in my hometown, and his best friend who was on the football team, and I was a theater kid. I hit him up anonymously on Instagram and said, hey, I know you guys play guitar, I play drums, we should jam.
I love it. It's always the drummers who get things started, man. Always.
Right? Exactly. See?
Because you've got the drum kit.
Right. We keep the beat. We set the tone. That's exactly it.
You hold the practice at your house, probably.
To the dismay of my parents at times. Right. And those two guys ended up becoming my two best friends in the world. So
wow.
We started a band. We were called Letterhead. That was my first big project. A lot of dreams. I convinced myself I could write and record an album in my basement. Did we release it on Spotify? Yes. Did we get worldwide acclaim? Perhaps not. But that was, you know, when we were 16, 17, we were scrappy. So we would every other weekend be out gigging. And that's how we made money during the school year. So, you know, I was able to offset some of the work that I did just by writing songs with the guys. And it was something that I always, always looked forward to, because no matter what happened in school, you know, for a long time, I was like, no, I can't join a debate team. And I'll get to what eventually happened with that, because you can imagine with innovation consulting, right, there's like, you're doing a lot of talking and a lot of sharing of stories. But at the time, you know, going to band practice was like no other feeling in the world.
That's amazing. What about getting into the writing part of it? Like, what prompted you to actually start writing, and what was that process like? And then since you were doing it in a band setting, like, were you always doing it in a band setting, or were you sometimes doing it solo?
So that's really interesting. The writing, I'm not sure who the source of this quote is, but one of my favorite quotes to describe it is that, you know, music is the sound of emotions. Music is the sound of feelings.
Yeah.
And when I was young, it actually all started with, I can pinpoint the song, Here, There, and Everywhere by the Beatles. So you're not going to believe this. I'd be in the shower, I was like 8 or 9, and, you know, kids sing in the shower and whatnot. I would sing the line to Here, There, and Everywhere, but I would add notes. I would add like counter melodies on top of it. And I remember being 9 years old, and it was late at night, and I could not get this thing out of my head. I had no idea how to play it. Like I was so young. But I got a notepad and just started scribbling. It was a slow build-up. My middle school chorus teacher.
Wait, what did you scribble? If you didn't understand how to. Sorry, well, I have to clarify here.
No, for sure. I didn't know how to play what was in my head, but yeah. I knew what I wanted to sing on top of it. So okay. I scribbled down lyrics.
Okay. Yeah. I thought you were like a genius prodigy child, like scribbling out the notes.
Yeah, Mozart. Didn't Mozart do something like that when he was like 3 or 4 or something insane?
Yeah, I thought you were Mozart.
Yeah, and cannot take that credit. So the writing was something that I did, you know, very, very casually. And again, I was very young. So the fundamentals kind of escaped me. But it was my middle school chorus teacher. So Mr. Savage, may he rest in peace. He unfortunately did pass of esophageal cancer the year after I had him. But even with the illness that he was fighting, he was one of the biggest advocates for people to get involved in music that I've ever come across. And I know there's the sense, right? Like, you are who your teachers help shape you to be. Mm. And with Mr. Savage, I had asked for a piano for Christmas so I could finally start learning the melodic side of things.
Right.
Outside of my drum lessons, which with my eccentric Beatles cover band drum teacher, story for another time, Ron, he's awesome. But I had this piano. I knew how to play with my two fingers. And Mr. Savage pulled me aside after class and he said, I know you're a good singer. Have you ever given thought to doing the end of year spring concert? And I said, actually, I've been writing a little bit of music. And he said, okay, perfect. I'll put you as the final act. And I was like, wait. And so that was the first big foray where I took my writing public. So,
wow, you were thrown into it.
Oh, yeah. I was having all my trepidations. And he said, you can do this. You're just playing in front of your peers. Just have a great time. So I wrote what I consider my first song from scratch. So I went home and was like, oh my gosh, it has to be perfect. Everyone's got to love it. The whole bit. Played the song and I was hooked. So ever since then, I've worked on my craft. So now I play. So while the drums, you know, they are my main instrument, I do play piano. I play guitar. I play bass. I try to be kind of an all in everything because one, it allows me to get out different song ideas that I have.
Yeah.
And two, it allows me to be kind of a versatile piece with no matter what band I'm playing.
I just love you sharing the story of your teacher because it's such a blessing, right? To have someone like that who such early age grabs you and really inspires and encourages you.
I think my trajectory would have been a lot different without that experience, to tell you the truth. And in his honor, when I got to high school, and I'll take us to the present shortly. When I got to high school, I said, for every concert, I'm going to audition for a solo and I'm going to write a song for it on piano because that's what Mr. Savage would have wanted me to do.
Wow.
And that's what I did. So twice a year, I would get up in front of, you know, the whole auditorium with all the parents in my little town, South Windsor, Connecticut, and I'd play songs that I wrote. And it was, you know, it was a great way to kind of break me into playing to larger audiences. And then, well, another pivotal moment for you. When I was 16, this was the step change. So I had a friend come up to me who was on the organizing committee for the school pep rallies. And now I had played to music-friendly audiences before, but she said, I think you'd be a great act to bring down a piano in front of the entire school and all of your teachers and all of the kids in every single grade and play the song that you just played. And I was like, I don't know if that's for me. And again, she pushed me to do it. She convinced me. So I did it. And that was one of my favorite moments looking back. Ever since, it was wild. I'd go into class and I couldn't formulate these sentences out the way that I wanted it to. And then I could, in the same day, go down in front of the entire school and play music without even thinking about it. So that's, again, to your point, like how differently the sides of your brain works.
Wow, that's incredible. I mean, so fascinating. And it's also vulnerable to share. Well, I think it's both vulnerable to share like your original music that you've written, and you have this like perfectionism and inner critic. So it's also the challenge of getting over that barrier. And I feel like that's such a barrier that people hold on to for so long. And in some ways, what a blessing that you were, you know, you were really almost forced, or you forced yourself with the inspiration from your from that teacher to do it so early. You probably built that muscle.
I mean, as Steve Jobs says, right, it's like the dots only connect when you look at them backwards. It's one of my favorite quotes. Really, what I see all of that as, you know, their experiments. And that's the biggest thing that I think is the challenge, right, with, because I have met folks, even fellow songwriters, some of my friends who are here in Boston, right, that are, you know, have shared with me in the past, hey, look, right, you know, I want this song to be perfect. I want this song to be all the way thought out. I want this to be my masterpiece and my master creation. And here's the thing. here's the thing about that. The best way to get started is just to write a sentence. It doesn't matter how you start. Sometimes for me, even still, it starts as earworms, it starts as a feeling, or it starts as just a line that I like the rhythm and spacing of. Being a drummer, I'm gravitated toward the rhythm. So sometimes I will, in my poetry, when I'm working through my poems, there will be a very rhythmic line, and I'll kind of just borrow it and put it in a song and then follow that rhythm in the vocal line, and that, you know, build some chords around it and a little bit of structure, and all of a sudden you have a song. And that's why somewhere where I would love to get in with you too is, you know, some of the new tools that are out there right now do an excellent job not at replacing the creative process, which I know that there's a lot of anxiety in the world about today,
right,
but ultimately augmenting it, right? Like,
yeah,
shorten it. The more that you can shorten the time between I want to do this and I'm doing this with music and songwriting, the better.
Yeah.
So, and some of those tools go a long way to do that.
No, I mean, absolutely. I think it's so funny because you playing so many different instruments, and you mentioned, you know, you are primarily a drummer. I was going to ask you that question that you're just starting to get into, because like as a beginner songwriter, I find that having the rhythm really prompts so much in like, to your point, both in lyrical inspiration and melody.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious, like, how often you start from rhythm versus guitar, piano, lyrics. Like, where do you typically, what's your process typically?
I mean, just like we were saying, the drummers keep the beat. I mean,
right.
Doesn't it all come back there?
Yeah.
So I will answer your question through the lens of an experience actually that I had. So Apalachee, the song that's out there.
Yes.
Under
okay,
my...
good. I wanted to ask about this.
Yeah. So the song that's out there under my solo name is a project that came after I played in a couple bands. So I had my band in high school, my band in college, which is amazing. And we still get together and play reunion shows. It's a blast. Mm-hmm. I love writing with those guys. And then I have this thing on my own so far, which is, again, right, just like we were talking about, an experiment. Playing on my own was something I was not super comfortable with before. And it was something where I found myself in a new city in Atlanta, Georgia. So after I graduated from the University of Connecticut, I put all my stuff in a car and I moved down to Atlanta, Georgia, and started up a new gig with the Boston Consulting Group. And that was, and my whole life changed in like a month. But when music is a part of you, right? And I know that you've experienced some of that now with songwriting, like it just becomes a part of you. The ability for that to follow me, again, taking more experiments, I found myself on the street in Atlanta busking, meeting all kinds of musicians. So to answer your question, I say all this to say, I had this foundation, I had this new name, I was Farr, Pharr, which was the street that I lived on in Atlanta.
Okay, and I was going to ask that too.
Yeah. So it was the street that I lived on in Atlanta. I remember feeling absolutely overcome with a feeling. And this is very typical of how I song right now. So I hate to take the cliche and say that it all starts from a feeling, because obviously that doesn't help super tactically.
I love it though.
But I mean, look, it was, I'll never forget it. It was a Tuesday night. It was a terribly long day. And when you grow up in Connecticut, the only thing that you have to do on the weekends for fun is go driving around aimlessly with your friends. So what did I do? I got a big 7-Eleven Slurpee, and I jumped in my car after a 12-hour day of calls, and I typed in a random town in East Georgia, and I just drove there. Didn't matter what was there. I just went for the drive. This was in, I want to say, October of 2022, and I just remember flying through the fields with the sunroof open, with the windows down, still warm down there, because that's not how it is up here. And when I got there, the goal was to write a poem. So whatever I felt on the car ride, I'd get there and I'd write a poem. And that's when I got the rhythm. So I started with the chorus of Apalachee, which is so I was following the Apalachee River as I did it. And so, two-lane road, nowhere. That's all just taking in and trying to encapsulate this moment, this thing that I was feeling. I still see songwriting as one of the most beautiful ways to encapsulate emotions. And so for me, because I'm a drummer, for the most part, it does start with a rhythm. Interestingly, from, like I said, right, like a line. So I'll pick up a line from one of my poetry books, and the rhythm is dot 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 dot. And then I'll make the next line dot 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 dot. Add some syncopation. You couplet that up. You got a verse. Then chorus, you invert the chords a little bit. And all of a sudden, right, in a matter of just now, I think most of my writing, I try to constrain myself. So I found that the songs that take me longer than 20 minutes to sit down and write the whole thing in a sitting are the songs that I usually just throw away. Because...
Wow.
Because... And this goes back to some other mantras that I live by, which I won't bore you with all the details, but one of them, which is my favorite, is the art of Wu Wei. And Wu Wei is essentially the Taoist philosophy that says the more that you think about doing something, the more barriers you're putting between yourself and the thing that you're trying to accomplish. So many folks get tripped up over, and I'm not sure if this is something that you've experienced being newer to songwriting, like I'm curious about what your experience has been in terms of balancing some of the newness, balancing the unknowns, and also, right, like trying to find the shortest possible distance to take, okay, this is in my head, this is the rhythm, or this is the chord structure that I have, and bring it to completion.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I think in some ways, I think for me coming at it newer, I didn't have as many of those like thinking barriers because like I wasn't trained in anything. So I was just like, okay, I'm just going to like put this song,
I love it. Yeah.
Throw it together. And I think now now the unknowns are feeling bigger, right? Because it's like I've been working at it and been learning. And so it's almost like, yeah, now those mental blockers are coming more, which is pretty interesting.
I mean, do you have synthesia?
Synthesia?
Ooh. So for some people, and I'm not going to diagnose myself, but I'm at least a little bit aware of it. So for me, having synthesia basically means that when you hear a sound, it conjures up an image or a color or it represents something, right? Like that. And it's funny because I hear some people, they go, oh yeah, see, that's like a deep green. And for me, that's very unsettling because it's a very navy blue. right. But it's absolutely fascinating the places that these things come up because, you can use, so I hack my synthesia to say, Okay. What am I feeling right now? Am I feeling overwhelmed? Do I have to get something off my chest? Am I feeling really elated and excited about something and have to expel that energy? If it's the former, where I'm feeling really compressed, I'm going to write a song in F major, C major, or B flat major, because all of those for me are blues.
Wow. That is fascinating.
And if I have like teeming energy like Appalachie, where it's just, it's free and it's open, I'll pick a red or an orange. So I'll do A, G, or D.
Wow. That's really cool. Yeah. It's funny. I think for me, it's not always so vivid,
totally.
But I resonate with your, what you said of starting with an emotion. Like, I think that is what really resonates with me.
Right. Yeah.
And then translating that into the song or the sound.
And so I think then it's interesting because there are many different routes to the emotion. You can go in with the words, you can go in the back door with the rhythm and set up the bones of it. I've seen people go and actually say, okay, I'm gonna start with a structure. So verse, chorus, when I'm writing a song, or chord structures. I think for me, chord structures are probably the least helpful because when I'm throwing on chords, they're just to help me move the song to a different tonal place. Everything else is rhythm, it's spacing, because music is math.
Music is math.
So I've never been good at math, but.
So, okay, what was the, so far you said was the name of the road in Atlanta, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was the decision to create this, as you say on your website, alter ego of Far versus, you know, just going with your name?
So I think it's really interesting. I have always enjoyed playing with other people. I think that songwriting itself is a beautiful way to encapsulate feelings in the sense of, you know, I could show you my music books. Every time I write a song, I pick out the date that I wrote it, and I have a little lexicon that I've developed, like a code to say, okay, you know, these are the major movements of the song. And the reason I do that is because it can take me back to a particular moment in time, and I'll know exactly how I felt and what I was feeling. I'm going to tie your question about Far to back to the brain for a second.
I love it.
What's even more fascinating is that when you start studying brain arousal and what feelings are conjured by the senses, that you find that there too, not all paths are created equally. For example, that smell is the most powerful way of conjuring an emotional memory, right? Because it's tied to your brainstem more closely. So with music too, like it conjures up a different type of memory than you get if you're seeing something dead on. For me, the most beautiful part of that is not just the moment, but it's sharing that with somebody else, sharing that with another person, with a group. For almost all of my bands in the songs that we play, whether it's, you know, Ben Letterhead or Julie's House, my college band, the most beautiful thing is I can go through this crazy episode in my life. I can put chords around it. I can make it so that somebody else can follow my story.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get a group of some of my best friends to get around me and we can all share in that moment together. And so the reason I did Far instead of Noah Frank is because I always wanted to leave that door open to sharing it with somebody else.
Wow. I love that. Oh my gosh. That's really cool.
So that's where the street musicians come in. So, okay. So probably one of my favorite bits of this story is, you know, as I told you, so I moved to Atlanta for this new job. And when I got there, I didn't know any musicians. So by word of mouth, I just started asking my roommates and my roommates' friends and my roommates' friends' friends who played and who did what. And, you know, a big way that I accelerated that process was I would take my guitar. So I had a Fender acoustic with no electric functionality or integration. And I go down to the Atlanta Beltline. I don't know if you spent time on the Beltline before.
I have not.
You know what that is? Okay, yep. So the Beltline is essentially a large loop that circles Atlanta and its former railroad tracks that they've turned into like a full pedestrian walkway. So it's great. You get little bars, there's restaurants, people walk their dogs there, and there's people busking all over the place. It's super well lit, it's super safe. I was like, what the heck? So I found a stump and I worked on the belt line. So one day after work, I brought my guitar down and just started playing some of my originals out of my songbook for people. I had no mic. I had nothing. It was just me and a guitar and my book. And people would skateboard up. People would come and, you know, dance, do the thing and go, hey, hey. But the best interactions that I had were people who would come up with their own instruments. There'd be dudes just walking with guitars that would say, hey, do you know how to play this song? Let's play together.
I love that. Yeah.
So I played with trombone players. I met drummers. I met bass players. I met all kinds of people who played all different kinds of music from all different walks of life. And so that's where I met all of the musicians that would come to play with me in Far. So Far is now a joint project very recently. I'm within the last couple of weeks. So my drummer, Shauna Mattson, who's down in Atlanta, she's been helping me produce from afar, helping me, no pun intended, helping me gather all of my thoughts. And so, you know, now it's a joint collaboration between us. And so the goal of naming it Far was always to have it so that it could grow into something that's shared with the right people.
Wow. I love that. That's really cool. Thanks for sharing that.
Of course.
So you started to talk about DAWs, digital audio workstations, and like the tools that they have. So I want to ask about that. Before I get there, my question is more about like collaborating in person versus like in a DAW and remote, because to your point, I think creating music in person, actually playing real instruments, it's such a unique experience, and like to be in a room with people. Mm-hmm. And we have the opportunity to create it one person in a DAW, have all these instruments, or have the ability to collaborate with people remotely through a DAW. So I'm curious like what those different experiences are like for you and how you think about them. And if you prefer, have preferences.
So I've done both. And I have different feelings about both of them. Do you listen to Pinegrove at all? So they have recently taken a hiatus, but they were one of my absolute favorite bands growing up. And their music, which I highly encourage anybody to listen to, is very loose in the sense of the connection that you feel between their lead singer, Evan, and the drummer, Zach, is incredible, because they'll leave these very pregnant pauses and then hit really hard, and their fours become swung at times depending on the feeling. These songs are, they're country twang-esque, but they're indie rock and they're very free-flowing. And so Appalachie, the one song that we have together with Far, that was a live take.
Wow.
Yeah.
I think that's also like rare.
I mean, it's so easy. And look, don't get me wrong, I love bedroom pop. It's easy and it's fast, because just as we were talking about, right, for some people, that's how you shorten the distance between idea and reality. I mean, most, I would venture to say that half of the songs that fall under the indie territory now use MIDI drums. Mm-hmm. You know, why would you spend the $600 to get good drum mics, and then however much money to get the drums and have a studio? And that's just drums. That's not even all of the different amplifier effects, because everything always sounds better analog. If you have an amp that you can actually mic up, even now it sounds more authentic.
Yeah.
Well, if you could cut all that to a fraction of the price by using integrations in the DAW, for most people that's good enough and it works. And I think that there's a real market for that now. And that's great. Like, I've done that. But I insist on live recording, not live mixing, not live mastering, all of that, that can totally be done remote. Mm-hmm. When you're in the moment, you can feel it in how perfect some of these songs come out, that the nature of their perfection creates a little bit of an unsettling effect, because at least for me, it calls into a question how genuine the feeling is. Mm. I think any human emotion has a certain degree where it's rough around the edges. Mm-hmm. And when you're playing together, to your point, right? Like, when you're playing together, it is such a different experience, because it allows you to embrace all of the imperfections of the moment. Was Appalachia a perfect take? No, of course not. But when it came out, you can hear the drums. The drums hit when they're supposed to because Sean and I were looking at each other. And there's just something about that level of deep communication that I just don't feel like you get with a lot of the DAWs. And they're phenomenal, right? Like right. I use Logic. I use I wouldn't be where I am were it not for the people that have supported me along the way. Like, for example, Michael Hitchcock, who, by the way, my producer, Michael Hitchcock of Argyle Records in Atlanta that helped me produce Appalachia, I met him on the street.
Wow.
I was playing a Pine Grove song. Right? This is where it all comes together. I was playing a Pine Grove song. He goes, "Is that Pine Grove?" And he stuck around. He said, "Play me something original that you wrote." And I did. And he said, "Okay, let me bring you down to the studio. Get a band together and we'll record it." And I'll tell you what, I will never go back. After doing live recordings, you just get such a different level of emotional depth.
That's so awesome. And I mean, there's so much that comes through in that song.
Thank you.
That vulnerability of the imperfection truly does capture that rawness of emotion.
Well, and you know, for me, even if you go to the lyrics, so I set up the song based around an introspection that I was having with regard to some of the experiences that I had when I was back in Connecticut. So being out there and driving in rural East Georgia, it made me feel like I was home. And so all of the lyrics are metaphors for things that I talked about with old friends, like our dads, and there's a line about economics classes that I took with old friends, right? Like stuff like that. And I layered them through because when you're in the act of playing it, a good song will take you there. A good song hits you like a ton of bricks. And that's only one purpose for listening to a song, sure, right? You're going to have your dance music. You're going to have stuff that pumps you up, stuff that you're listening to when you go to the gym. I like to make music for my favorite mood. And one bit of advice that I've gotten that I would highly recommend for anybody, because it has saved me from taking some extreme liberties with my songwriting: write music that you would listen to.
Mm.
So when I'm sitting down and my eyes are closed and I'm listening to music, I'm usually thinking through a problem or taking apart something in my brain. And if you can create your own soundtrack for that, like with your songs, like it ends up becoming a really beautiful tool. So not only are you fully immersing yourself in a moment, but you can also connect with a previous version of yourself and go back to where you were.
That has been, I think, the best thing of why I've fallen in love with songwriting.
Oh, I love that for you.
Yeah, you literally are just capturing, you know, little moments. And to your point that you mentioned of your catalog, you can go back and see, like, I know exactly how I was feeling at this moment.
And so the nature of recording then, if it's to sell a million records and quit your job, you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do it. That's what they're motivated by, and they're free to do it. I mean, these days you see less of those stories unless they start as Disney stars or something, because the other side is that I see these songs that crop up on the internet, and they'll amass millions of views by these really authentic, you know, kind of raw singer-songwriters from out in the country, and they're writing about war and about the topics and about the topics of today and how crazy our world is. And I just think that there's a big difference with intent too, right? Like if your song can evoke an emotion out of somebody else, any emotion, it is a successful song, which is why I have some problems with some of Green Day's latest records. And Green Day's one of my favorite bands, but like, you know, it's that kind of music where it's just, you don't feel anything when you listen to a royalty-free, you know, commercial little soundbite that's just right. And don't get me wrong, like you probably feel something. Like there's upbeat songs. There's slow moving, more introspective cases. But I think in terms of why you write songs, that also really does matter. Are you writing to explore yourself and share that, because if that's the reason why you're recording music, then I think you have a really strong case to be able to connect with other people just like yourself that you might not even realize.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think you're 100% right. And it's a blessing that like the tools are there to do it now.
Well, and look, you know, I think this gets into a larger point that we were just starting to talk about.
Yeah, that was going to be the next question. Yeah, because, you know, with all these tools comes the ability to use AI and potentially outsource certain parts of it, right? So, yeah, curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I have a lot of thoughts. I'm grateful for the question. I think first and foremost, and this has been a challenge with some creatives out there, the market for creative work nowadays is a rapidly and dynamically changing landscape. In a world where you can, I mean, now with all of these Gen AI backed music generators, in a world where you could totally outsource the process of songwriting and of everything, of conjuring that emotion and then bringing it out. Like, you don't even need to give it an emotion. It will give you something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what I tell creative folks is garbage in, garbage out, always, when it comes to these Gen AI systems, right? You have to be using it in the right way. But this goes to a larger point and something that I think, you know, we've been thinking about at Centaurian AI and Valise, two of the groups that I'm involved in, right? Which is that the effective use of artificially intelligent systems build best when they are built on top of deep mental frameworks and deep mental models of the goals that you're trying to accomplish. For example, somebody who doesn't know anything about songwriting, and I do not put you even anywhere close to this category, because look,
I'm honored.
The fact that you're writing you're writing, you're doing the thing, it's amazing. If you're starting from ground zero, you're one of those.
Yeah.
You're one of those aliens who says that they're not into music. I don't even know what that means. So I'm gonna set that aside. You know, if you had to write a song, ChatGPT will give you, you know, verses and choruses. It'll give you chord structures. It'll even, you know, I've asked ChatGPT to show me creative ways to invert chords. Like if I want to play like.
Yeah.
A certain inversion. And that kind of teases where I'm going with this, because if you don't have the deep knowledge, it makes it harder for you to be able to use these tools to get you something that you're proud to show.
Mm.
So I think this dream that a lot of people are sold on right now with regard to creative automation, I think about the business context of that, because you expand the aperture beyond songwriting to marketing and creative folks and designers. I mean, these are jobs that have been disappearing for some time. Now we're seeing, you know, some significant creative destruction, right? And the line that my mentors use is that way of thinking is a race to the bottom. If the solution is to completely outsource creativity to these however capable and however helpful technologies, you're losing out on potentially decades of real experience that if you equipped that professional to use it in a certain way, they could do extraordinary things. So to take it all home, I think what's really interesting about this moment that we're living in is that you've got your intellectual property concerns, which I think are a real thing, and they're actively being worked out in the courts, right? Okay, something is totally AI generated. What does that mean in terms of its commerciality, et cetera? Especially when that work is being built on top of other folks. So I think there's that angle of it, which I'm not a lawyer, so I will set that aside for now. But for me, I fall into the perfectionist trap at times where I'll have a stressful couple of weeks and I'm like, I've got nothing good to write about. And it's just never true. So for me, I'll take a poem that I have when I really feel like I can't get started, and I'll throw it into either Claude or ChatGPT, or not as much Perplexity, but I'll add it to the list because those are the big three that I use. And I'll say, okay, this is what I'm thinking for chord structure. I know I want it in the key of A, and I just hit it with some of the really specific questions that I feel like I can't move forward on because I need just a quick second opinion that's right there. And I've learned at times to songwrite with it. So I'd say anywhere from about 30 to 40% of my songs now, I'm pulling at least one of the chords that I use or one of the lines that I'm inspired by. I pull that from a large language model because I've been able to reinforce its knowledge with everything that I know. So I give it very clear parameters. Okay, here's what I've got. Here are my lyrics. Here's the rhythm that I'm going for. Here's the time signature. Here's what I'm thinking about. You know, like how can I take this idea to fruition? And just even having ideas to bounce off of, it's the classic creativity equation, because, you know, creativity is all about combining seemingly disconnected ideas. So, and I think that AI and Gen AI backed applications more specifically can be a really powerful tool to help people work through writing blocks. And if they have questions about things, like to have a real life interface where you're thinking with the machine, you're thinking through the problem.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And like, basically what you're saying is you really need to understand the discrete elements of the process and break it down. And not just say like, write me a song, but like, hey, here's the lyrics, here's the time signature, here's like exactly. the BPM, et cetera. And then using it as a sounding board. But I have a question, because how do you think about that relative to a co-writer, right? Because a co-writer who is a human would essentially be doing a similar role to what you're now using ChatGPT for.
So I think it totally depends on your circumstances, right? I think for a very long time, I did co-write songs. So with some of my bands, that was a lot of fun. I found that once you add like a third person into the writing equation, you kind of get too many cooks in the kitchen. But having a partner to bounce ideas off of and write things, tremendously helpful for that exact reason. Like you can act as a springboard for each other's creativity to bounce ideas that you didn't think of before. I think while Gen AI systems don't fully replace the human-to-human interactions of that, and the deep, you know, mental models and knowledge, it does offer a comparable experience for folks that I think are just getting started. I think for that, you know, for folks in circumstances where you don't have that writing partner, this is an excellent stand-in. So, I mean, even for me, right? Like some of my songwriting partners are all around the country at this point. I can't just hop on a plane and fly to Georgia to work on a song with Sean anymore. So if I want to stay in the moment, and if there's one thing that I can tell anybody who's listening out there, it's when you're writing a song, never come outside of the moment. It doesn't matter if it takes 2 hours or if it takes 15 minutes. The moment you leave an unfinished idea and come back to it, you might write an amazing song. But that initial capture, that initial shot of thinking that goes into what lyrics you're putting in, where you're talking about, it can fundamentally change the story or the feel. And so that's why I say, and why I said earlier that for me, most of the songs that I write happen within 20 to 25 minutes. So when I'm co-writing with somebody, it's excellent because we spend that 20, 25 minutes together. But if I'm engrossed in it, and my co-writer's busy, this is an excellent way to get at least a draft one. Nobody's saying you can't come back to an idea after you've rounded out the circle on it. But I find that the best songs of mine are ones where I power through it, where I stick with it. Even if I just come up with a haphazard ending and some lyrics to get it done, finish your thought. I think that's the biggest. And if AI helps you to do that, then it's a powerful, powerful tool.
Yeah, no, that's it resonates a lot. I think makes a lot of sense. And it's to your point that captures the emotion in the moment, which is what you're going for.
And I think that this can show up in a larger context too. So when I was interviewing for my job with BCG, I was leaving the public policy world. So in another life, the other side to the stutter story is that I stuck with it. I got the help that I needed. I relearned how to speak in the matter of about a year and a half. And after that, I chose probably the career path that requires the most talking of all time, which is I had this dream of being a lawyer. So I went to UConn as a poli-sci student, and all of a sudden I was in student government, and I was in all these different societies, and you know, a lot of trying to express myself. But this songwriting, the creativity that having, again, these deep mental models since I was very young, the way that that afforded me to think convergently and divergently at times was phenomenally useful, to the point when I was working for my own startup. I was working for a small political consulting group in Fairfield County, and we were helping out campaigns. It was I learned so much about running your own business. I did all the invoicing, I did the strategy. It was amazing. I was 21. And, I applied to BCG's creative agency, which is that job that ultimately brought me to Atlanta. And I'll never forget in the second interview that I had with them, we spent the entire interview focused on songwriting. So I had included, you know, they asked like, okay, like, how do you show up creatively for yourself? And I had a 40-minute conversation with an associate director about synthesia and about it's crazy where these things show up, because it actually has so much more impact on our left brain world than I think we realize.
Absolutely. Yeah, I totally get it. And having been in those two worlds as well, like there's so much parallel between them. And to your point, like the creative side of the brain feeds the analytic, and the analytic is critical to the creative side.
Well, exactly. And it's about, you know, like distilling the core ideas. You know, the most amazing part about creativity is that the more you use it, the more you have it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a depleting resource.
I love that.
And creativity compounds.
Mm.
So if you're constantly combining novel ideas when you're off of work and putting time and energy into these songs, it's been my experience that it only makes you more creative when you show up at work to think divergently and to help, you know, it's been an interesting journey over the last couple of years to see how creative thinking in one context really does bleed into another.
Yeah.
And to put a really fine point in it, that's where I think a lot of these conversations about AI come to their head. Because for so many people, AI is a tool to schedule calendar invites, take meeting notes, send an email, do all the stuff I don't want it to do. It comes from Machine Platform Crowd, which is one of my favorite books about the subject. And essentially the idea is that, you know, for a long time we had a standard partnership with our digital devices. Okay, they're going to handle all the math, all the things we don't want to do, but we're in charge of the creativity. What happens when you have deep learning is that you have systems that are at times performing and coming up with more creative combinations than we can. I think one of the biggest bottlenecks with this new technology is what we conceive that we can do with it. So in the business world, a big part of innovation right now, how you creatively think about AI, it comes from all of my divergent uses of the technology. In a lot of our work where we're advising clients and we're helping companies navigate disruptive transformations, it's poetic in a sense that I feel like I can bring my entire self in the ways not only that I am creative, but also critically creatively using the technologies. And I feel like that's what we miss so much of the time when we say, I don't understand it. I'm not sure what it does. I'm not sure how it'll help me. So it probably can't help me. And there's a number of heuristics that we take to get us there so that our brains don't get overwhelmed. But that's something that I'm starting to see the conversation change. And my hope is that more creatives see how empowering of a tool that this can be and not just a job replacer. I feel like that very mutually exclusive thinking about it's either I'm the creative or it's creating.
Right.
It actually does more to harm us than it does to bring us together about what's possible.
Well, and it's actually an invitation to learn more of the process, right? It's because essentially, you know, you can't interact with it and collaborate with it if you haven't been a student of like the fundamentals of everything, every step along the way.
And to that point, you know, we talk about deep mental models. So partially where I get my love for rhythm is that for me, even to this day, speaking is still a rhythm. When I was working on my technique to combat my dysfluency, we would do helpful exercises like easy onsets. So ready for this? So rather than saying a very percussive word like pepper, you would say pepper. Mm. You'd skip over those percussive sounds to improve fluency. Because fluency, all it really means is that you speak smoothly. So there's no problem with the ideas that you're getting across. It's just how you do it. And I see in a very similar sense a really apt connection between fluency and songwriting. So if this technology increases the likelihood that you're going to be able to cogently get from the idea that you have, from whatever earworm is in your head, from the poetic line that you know you've got, but you're not sure how to get it to completion, like that's why these tools can be so helpful. You know, for me, it all comes back to rhythm. That's what I love. And so I use the technology to help me improve in the areas that I'm not as strong in. For example, you know, the intonation of songs and chord structures, et cetera. So you can be imaginative in different ways. And I don't see it as an either or.
Yeah, no, I love that. When you were talking earlier about the experience of listening to music and music being written, you know, by a human, thinking about like why people listen to music, it's like to connect with the experience that you're getting from that song, like to be understood by it. And so I think so often you want to understand like the story behind what this person was going through when they were writing, or there's that like eagerness to understand it, right? But on the other side, sometimes the artist really just wants to have it be out there and have it be like, you know, whatever the listener's experience is. So I'm curious, like, totally. Do you like to understand behind the song, or do you like to let that just be your experience?
I think they both have a beautiful way of looking about them. I think that the real power of the way that music connects people is that you, Jenna, you're going to write a song about something that's incredibly personal to you. You might dress it up in some lyrics that speak more generally. Maybe you've got a song where you kind of fluctuate right between different stanzas of you get really specific about your experience and then go into a big takeaway about what that all means for you. And I think the real beauty of an effective song, to continue that logical flow, right, is that they can be both. What ideas are conjured in your mind when you play a song, they're never going to be one for one what happens in somebody else's brain, even if they know your story.
Yeah.
So I always like to appreciate where my artists are coming from when I'm listening and when I'm methodically thinking through the lyrics and trying to understand the story, because we are storytelling creatures. Right. And we thrive off of the stories that we tell and the legacies that we live through it.
Yeah. I love that. It can be both.
But it can be both. Right. Like it's in that way, what is somebody else's can also be yours.
Absolutely. Well, Noah, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. This has been such a wonderful start to the day. I'm so inspired.
Me too. I mean, look, you asked amazing questions, Jenna. Thank you so much for this time. And it was a pleasure to be with you and to learn from you as well.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed the episode with Noah Frank. To learn more about Noah, check out his website, noahsfrank.com, and listen to his music on major streaming platforms under the artist name Far.